Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast, number 511. Hostful intro, sort of. No,
511. My favorite kind of Levi's skinny jean.
Yeah. Oh, good. Nice tie-in.
Love a good skinny jean.
Well, I know. I know you enjoy fashion.
I do. I'm big fashion. Wearing some Target clothes.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
You mean a Target for...
Target for ridicule. Well, sounds like that's what's going to happen right now.
This episode brought to you by Target. we'd like to... do you have any shows coming up that you want to promote?
Bro, I don't think so.
Besides the Wednesday night Meltdown Comedy Meltdown show?
Yeah, just every Wednesday. Meltdown Comics still doing
it. Who was here Wednesday night?
Well, this past Wednesday was a great show. Great show. Ali Wong, who is one of my favorite At Midnight contestants.
Yep.
Kyle Kinane.
Yep.
Sarah Silverman. Who else was on? Hasan Minhaj was on, and he actually has like this really cool documentary on PBS coming out about comedy. We should actually have him on talking about it.
Okay.
It's really cool. We went around the world talking to people about comedy.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. Like, talk to Bill Cosby, talk to people like, who, like, you know, huge comics in other countries that don't speak, you know, just about almost a lot of the stuff that we talked about with Eddie Izzard.
Okay. Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah,
that'll be coming up pretty soon. The Eddie Izzard episode, which was super, super fun.
But yeah, great episode. Great time. Great time.
It was a good time. We're doing At Midnight Live May 16th and 17th in Nashville as part of the Wild West Comedy Festival. Also, I'm going to be doing stand-up at Wise Guys in West Valley City, Utah, near Salt Lake City. May 29th, 30th, and 31st. And then Portland in June at Helium. And then some other dates coming up. Oh, and then at Meltdown here, we do beta test every couple weeks where three comics do 20 minutes of brand new material. It's a free show. So if you go to nerdist.com/calendar, you can get info on that.
Oh, we're doing a Meltdown at the Bridgetown Comedy Festival in Portland.
Nice.
Which is the weekend of May 10th. We're also doing a live Jonah Radio on that Saturday of the festival in Portland. We're going to have Lance Bangs. We're going to have one of the people on the show is going to be the guy from the Thermals, the guy who sang for the Thermals. And then a guest band that we're working on right now.
Fantastic. We're going to be relaunching the Nerdist website soon, so some of the URLs might change. But we're relaunching that May 7th.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Make it all snazzy. Well, we never had a mobile version of the site. It was just a crappy plugin.
Yeah.
So we designed sort of a mobile version first and then sort of ported that over to desktop instead of the reverse.
Oh, fun.
So it'll be, I think it's pretty nice looking. I'm pretty freaking excited about it.
What fun.
It's a good thing for us. I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Our pal John Oliver, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, is on HBO. It premieres Sunday, April 27th at 11 p.m., 10 Central. It's on HBO. It's basically just John kind of taking a look back at the week and filtering it through the amazing John Oliver lens.
24 hours a day.
No, he's not. It's not. The show's not on for 24 hours
just
a day.
Every night.
It's on Sunday starting April 27th.
Okay.
On HBO.
So what if something happens Sunday night?
Well, it could be on the following Sunday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty cool.
Did it? Well, I love John. John was. We should have him back on the podcast.
It's been a while. I think it was the live one in Austin.
It was the live one in Austin. Yeah, from when we went down there for South by.
Yeah.
Damn. So very excited to see John's show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver Sunday, April 27th, only on HBO. This episode of the podcast is Rhys Dobby, who I didn't know. I loved Rhys on Flight of the Conchords.
Yes.
Has always been great on At Midnight, but I didn't know what to expect because I've never really talked to him outside of that character of sort of Rhys Dobby.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I don't know what's gonna, and He was great.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe I'm just a dick I was underestimating him. I'm like, I wonder what he's going to talk about. Mm. Well, but he's a human being and he's a smart guy and he has a lot of really fascinating things and he fucking climbed a mountain. And
yeah. And plus, I checked out his show that you
Short
told
Poppies.
Me about Short Poppies, yeah. Which is on Netflix.
Netflix right now. Yeah.
You told me about it. I went home and watched a couple episodes. It is great.
Yeah. But basically, I guess maybe it was funded by the government of New Zealand, who funded this project. Of Jeez. Basically him going around. He plays a lot of different characters in these small New Zealand, you know, around New Zealand.
Yeah.
And this presenter kind of goes through, and it's Reese is the character. So.
Yeah, different character for each episode.
For each episode, yeah. So Short Poppies is on Netflix. Here's Nerdist Podcast number 511 with Reese Darby. Present? Not present?
Yeah, present.
We're not good at this accent.
Jermaine.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
No, I don't. I'm not a good cold person. I don't know why. I've lived all over this country.
Mm-hmm.
Cold climates.
You say you're more of a hot man?
I'm a hot man.
Okay.
I appreciate hot things.
No, we got that.
Nope, it doesn't work that way.
I'm a hot man, says Chris. We got it.
That's how I talk all the time. How do you enjoy America?
I enjoy it very much so. How do I do it? Well, I just...
What's your process for enjoying America?
I take it in with my eyes.
Okay, and then what?
And then I learn. You mm-hmm. know, there's a lot to learn here.
Is there sound processing going on too, or is it just visual?
There's certainly sound, but, you know, visuals come in first.
Yeah.
And then I experience things, touch, feel.
Mm-hmm. How do the smells compare here?
Not good.
No, I wouldn't think so.
That's not a big...
think so. Especially not Los Angeles.
Yeah, you could get away with just disregarding the smell thing.
have you been to... have you kind of been into deep America, or have you just sort of been in the coastal regions?
Mainly on the sides. Mm-hmm. I went to Bonnaroo.
Oh, nice.
So
yeah.
That's down there. Portland.
Yep, good town.
Which I really love. And... Yeah, so Chicago. I mean, I've been to a few places.
Tennessee.
But not for long, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not long enough to really experience it, yeah.
Tennessee's a good example, but when you kind of get to a small town where there are not a million different things competing for one another, you kind of get a consistent, like, oh, this area kind of smells like this, and it's nice, and there's a consistent point of view here. Portland is sort of has that, mm-hmm. where you go, oh, okay, I see, there's this kind of unifying thing that defines, like, this is Portland. Los Angeles is just a mishmash of people trying to get famous as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it's not a good it's not a good thing. But everyone comes here, and then you know, the longer you spend here, you go, hey, let's branch out and see what this country's really about. And that, I think that's sort of, that'll happen to me eventually.
It is pretty remarkable. I mean, the landmass that is the contiguous United States is pretty incredible how big it is. And it is fun to, if you ever get a chance, you should drive across it, because it's just, you get the spectrum of every different type of thing all in one. I so want to go to New Zealand, though, and I've never had the time to go.
Well, you know, when next time you get a long weekend, you
pop down for a day.
You've got to do it.
Well, you guys were doing that, right? I feel like Brett and Jermaine would just pop back to New Zealand for like a couple days, mm-hmm. and then come back.
Really?
It felt like they were going back and forth all the time.
Well, yeah, we do. And for us, it's like an 11 and a half hours flight.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem, you get used to it.
Yeah.
You tell people that and they go, oh, that is just crazy. I couldn't do it. I will not do that in my lifetime. You know, I said, well, what are you? It's 11 hours. It goes so quickly.
Sure.
Because we fly at night. That's always the thing. You know, you get on the plane and then you literally, you have your dinner. You know, you start watching a film and then you fall asleep and, you know, and then you wake up in New Zealand. I mean, that's the ultimate. But of course, that's first class travel. I mean,
sure.
The reality is, if you're in coach it's an uncomfortable 11 hours. I mean, you can obviously take something to make sure you knock yourself out for a few hours here and there. But
sure.
Yeah, it's just, if you look at it in the significance of your life, it's only a tiny period, and then you're there, and then you forget about it. It's like pregnancy, you know.
It's just like that. Just you get pregnant 11 yeah. hours later, you have
yeah.
a baby.
Yeah.
And it comes right out. It's funny that I could spend 11 hours in a day just doing nothing yeah. or playing a video game and just wasting 11 hours.
Status updates, chicken things.
Exactly. But if someone said, oh, you could spend that time and then you could be in another culture, I'd be like, ooh, 11 hours? I don't know. Ooh,
yeah,
I could really be interneting a lot.
I guess that's the thing. They're at that point now where if you can internet a lot during that time up there, then you're not changing anything.
No one's doing transcontinental internet service yet, though.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
And I don't want that to happen because I think, for me, air travel is about, it's nothing time. No one can get hold of you. You're out.
But how do you know what's trending on Twitter? I don't even understand what you're saying right now. So am I supposed to just make up my own? I'll have to notebook paper just yeah. write like, hashtag bitches be all like, hashtag
yeah.
movie puns, hashtag whatever the crazy trending topics are.
Think of it as going back to the olden days.
What? on a technologically yeah. advanced super transport.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always think about how well... I think most of us would probably not fare well even 50 years ago. I think people would go crazy even 50 years ago. I don't know how. I think some people would acclimate, but other people, I think they would just stand in the middle of the street and go, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. What's happening? Do you like, or do you unplug for periods of time
yeah,
besides
I do.
Air travel?
I do. I'm not a big checker. You know, I mean, emails, I mean, they come through and I'll do a session where I'll just go through and, you know, delete them all. But yeah, I'm quite happy to detach myself from, you know, electronic scenarios for a while because I just does my head in. You know, you can get so involved in it.
What is the what's the preferential term for a New Zealander? Is it Kiwi or
okay? Yeah.
Is everyone in your culture pretty laid back? Because the Kiwi that I know are all pretty like, oh yeah, whatever.
Yeah,
everything's fine.
I think that tends to be our thing. We're very laid back. I guess our country is, you know, it's nice, it's relaxing, great beaches. You're never more than 20 minutes away from a beach, and the food's great. Lots of trees. I think not much work going on. I think a lot of it is that kind of we just hang out and you know, barbecue, and you know, you've got to make sure that the cows are milked. That's, you know, you get up early for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Business wise, you know, modern technology, the IT situations, people with, you know, modern, not that farming's not a modern job, but it has been around forever.
Sure.
People that work in buildings and stuff, not stuck in traffic all day, I guess. Another thing, they just sort of get up and, you know, take the lift or elevator, as you call it. And
whoa, wait, what?
Whoa, you haven't. You don't know?
This is America, sir. Please stick to American references.
I offered it up, but they are called lifts.
God damn it.
And it's an easier word.
Although, elevator rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, elevator.
Elevator.
Mm. What about the fact that they go down as well? That's always confused me, because even lift. With lift.
A reverse
elevation,
lift.
Elevator.
Reverse elevate.
Maybe back in the day they only went up.
That's it. That was the problem.
Yeah.
The elevator itself has been around for a very long time. It just wasn't until the last century they figured out how to go down.
Yeah.
So a lot of people would just go to the top of a structure and die.
That's it. They're up there. A lot of people are still up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, still.
In those very old buildings where they haven't yet.
Where the Jetsons live.
They're up there.
Just up there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just waiting. Did you... there's a sort of famous story that... famous and I think in comedy nerd circles
let's see if I've heard of it.
Well, it's a Concorde story.
Oh, okay.
That just
and there's a good chance.
And just sort of the nature of, you know, what should be really important and what's like how seriously we take the entertainment business, and then you realize when people who aren't from here are like, oh yeah, it's fine, but it shouldn't be your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
When the HBO show got picked up, I heard Brett and Jermaine were at lunch. And their agent called and said, "Hey, great news, the show got picked up." And I think Jermaine was like, "Yeah, we're eating. Is it all right if we call you back?" They're like, "No, your show got picked up." Yeah, we got it. We just like to finish lunch. Like totally. And then stories about how they would turn down SNL and they just didn't really embrace like all the things where you go, "Oh my God, you finally made it, this thing you work for." And they're like, "Yeah, no, it's fine, but we just don't really."
That's all true. And I think, you know,
I so respect and admire that.
Yeah, the fact that they decided to end it as well. A lot of people think the show was canceled. It was not. They just wanted to bow out after two seasons.
I heard HBO begged them to come back and they said they just didn't want to do it anymore.
The story's been told and we've done it. Let's move on to the next thing. So it's kind of like, very laid back attitude, very kind of, they never jumped up on top of a van with a megaphone and announced that they wanted to be world famous or anything like that. They just played guitars and made cool music, and you know, people turned up to watch them in tiny theaters, you know, and then it got bigger and bigger, and then it almost got too big for them. I don't know if that generation of that type of people exist. I'm sure it does, but certainly not so much here in LA, where people are, you know, desperate to really make it, and a lot of them do. But
definitely, but also the idea that I think there's sort of an assumption. I don't know if this is an American assumption, but I feel like from my vantage point, it has been sort of a platitude of American culture, which is bigger is always better. Like, as big as you can scale something, the better. And I feel like it's very rare that people go, "No, at a certain point, this is probably about the right level for this thing, it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be good if it's any bigger."
That definitely is an American thing. Bigger is better. I mean, that we all know that, and to a certain degree, you know, that's right. But I don't. And in art, I don't think it is. I think it's about forming something, creating something for the perfect size, and then releasing it for everyone to see, and then maybe for it never to be completely perfect, for people to come in and chip away at it themselves, and no one will ever be completely satisfied with something that's artistically created. But it's about getting most people to agree that, you know, you've nailed it.
Yeah. what are your goals as a performer? I mean, obviously, you know, do you do a lot of live stuff anymore?
I do. I still write a stand-up show every couple of years, and I've just finished my new one, which I'm going to tour with next month, actually this month in New Zealand, and then the UK in July. So the last one I did was 2012, and every time I finish one, and I think, well, that's the best show I've ever going to write. I'm never going to beat that. I'm never going to come up with any more material. That's it. I'm out, you know. And I take a year off. And during that year, I'm sort of, you know, subtly writing notes, coming up with ideas and going, "Oh, maybe that would work. What are you doing, dear?" "Oh, just a few ideas. I thought you'd finished with all your ideas." "No, well, I am, but these are just some backups, you know, just in case, you know, we might want to do another thing at some point." And then the following year, you know, it's I've got all the stories and there it is. And so I put them all together and I've got a new show. So, I like the level I'm at now. I like doing that maybe every couple of years. I used to, you know, when I was in the UK, we would have to have a show every year. We'd take it to Edinburgh, you know, and put it on the Fringe. And it would be and a lot of comics, you know, they didn't have enough material, or the show wasn't as strong. So there was a lot of pressure on that because the rest of the year we're all, you know, working most nights of the week in clubs. So now that I'm detached from that scenario, I've got a hell of a lot more time to write and to actually go out there and have the adventures that the stories will come from, because I'm not really a joke writer, you know. I mean, I'll slip a couple of zings in there for sure. But, you know, I've got a small collection of yuck yucks, but, really, it's about experiences and going out there and doing things and then telling stories about them.
I mean, the Fringe Festival, I've never done it, and it really feels like, this is the triathlon of comedy. I mean, it almost seems like that experience that there's really, I can't think of any other comedy experience that's like that. You know, you have to, you're doing a show every night, and you're also, I mean, probably not for you so much anymore, but having to run out on the streets and market it too, and try to get people in because you're in, you know, you're in quotation marks competition with a million other shows, and how do you get people there, and how do you evolve, and what's the ultimate, you know?
Yeah, and it's a beast, and you're also trying to get on all the lineup shows, all the late shows, just to make an appearance, just to get your face out there and do 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, get on other people's shows, and I mean, it's very exciting, especially for young comedians. It's and Edinburgh in particular really is a massive school camp. It's where everyone from across the globe comes in, and so it's a celebration of comedy. And there's other festivals, obviously Melbourne. Even there's one in New Zealand. There's several here, and I think, those are huge opportunities for comics who are, it's a very solo job. You're on the road. You don't really get to hang out with each other. You see each other now and again on bills, you know, lineups, but really during that month, in particular for Edinburgh, you get to hang out with each other for, you know, 4 weeks and just catch each other's shows and then catch up. And it's a lot of drinking going on. It gets messy, you know, but you kind of feel like, haven't we got the greatest job in the world? You know, we just tell jokes and drink.
Oh, I think it sounds wonderful. I went 1 year in the 90s. I went and just watched. And then I happened to be in Edinburgh last year just for a couple of days. And it's such a gorgeously, I mean, like a vertically layered city.
Oh yeah.
And, but it definitely feels like, wow. I don't drink anymore, but when I was still drinking, I can imagine just waking up and being like, am I in a fucking nightmare? Like, because there are corners of Edinburgh that are so, where you just go, well, that's haunted for sure. Yeah. I mean, it is almost like a nightmarish first-person shooter game.
It is. It's a dark and twisted Charles Dickens novel, you know, and you don't know where you are, and the stairs going up, but as soon as you get down there, you realize you're on top of a hill.
Yeah.
You know, it's twisting and white, and you can see, you just see bodies everywhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Not just living bodies, but like, oh, this is where they used to bury the poor people.
Oh, yeah.
This hill that just looks like a grass formation is littered with bodies.
The venues that I used to perform in, they're called the caves.
That's
where they hid the people that had the plague. They were, you know, and there was ghosts. I mean, it was, but it all just adds to the whole thing, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's great, especially because it, you know, the I've never done Melbourne. I've always wanted to do Melbourne, but I've done Just for Laughs a ton, and Montreal's a really beautiful city, and it definitely has a lot of history. But I would, you know, but going to a city that actually has like a millennia of history, to do comedy feels like it would be a really, really great experience. But I think you can't just go to, I know technically you can go to Edinburgh for a couple of weeks, but I feel like if you're going to do it, you should just do it for the whole month.
Yeah. Well, if you want to get your badge, you got to do it the whole time. Yeah. I mean, and I'd done it like 8 times, and as I most of those times I was, you know, struggling to get people. And then after the Concords, I managed to, you know, really get big crowds, and I felt like finally, you know, I've nailed it. And then I got to the point where, hey, I don't even have to do 4 weeks anymore. I'll just do 10 days, you know, in and out. And it felt really good. And was I cheating on the whole thing? Well, I don't think so, because I'd done my hard yards.
You earned it.
I earned it, so I got the badge.
Yeah, I think if I ever had anything that aired in England that allowed me to sort of, you know, circumvent all that other stuff, I don't think I would want to do that. I don't think I would want to circumvent it, because I would really want to have the full experience and not the cushy first class experience of
good.
Because I think
a good man.
No, I think it's more, you know, it's so easy because, you know, human beings seek comfort. That's just what we do, because we like to be comfortable. I'm like, I have a fucking space heater in this room. I can't even deal with the fact that it's a few degrees colder. But you know that. But then at a certain point, I think you get so far down the comfort path that you've just lost touch with why you do what you do and what it's really about and what the real experiences are, that you're, you know, there's a gap between you and the audience. And I think it's important to still do that stuff.
Yeah, you're right. You've got to remember the base of our craft is to be the every person and to, you know, be these people that are watching you so that they can relate to you, not to be a, you know, high and mighty. And I think, yeah, feel the grunge and feel the pain. And, you know, that's what comedy is. It's close to torture.
Just at the edge.
Yeah.
It's just at the edge of torture where it's like...
You're sort of leaning over, you know, like one of those video games when you're Tomb Raider or whatever, and when you get too far to the edge and the character leans over, does a little... You can't see this.
He's flapping his arms, and then you just pull yourself back.
Yeah.
But I think maybe even one more step than that, which is if you fall forward, it's like crocodiles wrapped in razor wire, and the other side is like a cloud of orgasms. Like they're these two.
Yeah,
it's either one. Yeah. You know,
one arm lands in both. You know,
I'm so mixed about how I'm feeling right now.
That's how it should be. That's comedy, folks. Yeah,
but it is
pleasure and pain.
I think it's especially important to because the. My early comedy was so America pop culture centric that I couldn't really perform anywhere else. I realized, you know, like, oh, I went to London and performed a little bit, and then in Canada years and years and years ago, and I realized, like, oh yeah, I just, you know, I can't just keep making America pop culture references. I need to figure out how to talk to other audiences. And you know, I mean, even beyond culturally, this sort of experiment of, you know, if you translated your set into another language, would it still work? I mean, obviously there are subtle colloquial nuances that may or may not work, but does the subject matter really speak to humanity and not just your own culture?
Yeah, and I think that's really important, especially for comics who are going to go abroad. And right from the beginning, my stuff's always been universal, sort of. And some British comics came over to New Zealand and they said, you know, you should go to London. Your stuff would travel. Because I said, why? Well, you know, you're not doing anything New Zealand specific. I mean, you're talking about mermaids, jetpacks, you know, you do a lot of sound effects that can, you know, and the physicality, which I put in the act as well. And so I took that advice and it did travel, you know, and I even performed in East Berlin. And they really dug the Tyrannosaurus Rex impression. You know, there's kind of things like that. And you know, it's one of the reasons Rowan Atkinson with Mr. Bean has just been able to go everywhere.
Oh, of course.
So I'm glad that I chose... Well, it's not really an option, really. That's just how I do comedy. But it has been... It's opened far more doors than if I was, you know, doing witty one-liners about, you know, New Zealand politics.
Sure. is the comedy scene in New Zealand fairly robust? Are there a lot of clubs, or is it like, oh, you know, there's a place in Christchurch or there's a place here in
yeah, it's
Wellington.
Pretty much there's a place there. I think that might still be open. You better check. It's kind of like that. There's one proper comedy club in Auckland called The Classic, home of live comedy. I think that's its motto.
just in case you were confused about what a stand-up comedy club might be.
Excuse me, is this the home of live comedy? Yes, that's right. excellent. I'm just downstairs.
Sorry, we're just really a timeshare of comedy. Yeah. 2 weeks out of the year.
Yeah. I'm looking to purchase it. Right. How funny are you? And yeah, it's small, but it's certainly got bigger over the years. And so there's, you know, there's comedy clubs that have popped up. Well, you know, like really just bars that are doing a night once a month or whatever, sure. You know, that kind of thing. So it's small, but since I started, yeah, there's definitely a scene now. And we even have a TV show where comics can come on, and it's like a panel show. It's called 7 Days. And so yeah, it's. But first, when I first started, you couldn't really say that New Zealand really had. A stand-up scene, but now I think we really do, and it's cool. I mean, you know, I think it started in America in the 80s, and we've finally got our own scene now in 2014. You know,
late 70s, beginning into early 80s was sort of the beginning of this 14, 15-year comedy bubble where it was, you know, there was a comedy club in every corner and, you know, three comedy shows on television of just stand-up.
Yeah, wow.
And you just see the same, it was a bunch of people, but you just see the same people pop up on different things. And it really, we were a very stand-up-centric culture. And then in like around 92, it just, like, people just were like, nah, we're going to go spend our money doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of, you know, like it just popped. But I definitely think I think we're back in it now. I think we're, you know, maybe it's just because of the show that I do and the circles that I'm in, but I feel like I see so much innovative, wonderful comedy happening right now.
Interesting stuff. And, you know, comedy's never going to go away. It's part of how we feel. But it's also become so international here too now. So we've got, you know, so many people from all different countries that are residing here, and they get up on the stage and see you. There's so much flavor to it.
Yeah. Just having this conversation with you now is a little bit, because we've never really sat and talked for any length of time. I mean, you did, first of all, thank you for doing the things that kill you.
Series
for the Nerdist channel was fucking amazing. But I definitely feel like there's kind of a, there's a performance character of Rhys Darby, mm-hmm. and then there's just you as a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And do you see the difference? Do you see the gap between those two things, or did you evolve that guy? I mean, because he's you, but he's like he's a little bit. I don't know how to describe him, but he's like a dimension. I think of you like this inflated dimension of you.
Yeah, and the best thing about that dimension is I can slip into it any time, and I know when I'm in there, and I enjoy it. I enjoy it, and then I slip back just to get some information and find out what's going on, where I'm supposed to be, and then I slip back and do it, you know, and sometimes... So it is. I'm multidimensional, which is fascinating, and a lot of people aren't. But for me, it's my thing, and I guess, yeah, slipping into my bizarre dimension and staying there for too long, I can overheat and really get confused and... But it is, for me, it's my happy place. And, yeah, I love making people laugh. And the real me, you know, I'm a dad. I've got two kids. And I do a lot of dad humor. But really, it's a thinking cap. And then the other one is, you know, like a fun little cap with a little propeller on it.
But that guy, but that character can do dad jokes and they're...
Oh,
amazing.
Yeah.
As opposed to
I don't
just
know
a guy,
how he
just,
does it,
just
this guy. It's the way he talks. It's just something about the way he looks. And he can generally do anything and get away with it. And so I sometimes, like I say, I try to be him for a longer period of time. And I overheat.
Yeah.
I have to sort of, you know, pull myself together because I don't even know where I am or what I'm doing. This just sounds really wanky.
No, I don't think it's that. I mean, I...
Yeah, that's him talking, by the way.
Wait, who am I talking to now?
Come back into my dimension. What? You sent me here? You're overheating. You've had too many of those vegan dried California peaches. You can't even say vegan. It's pronounced vegan. Or vegan. Doesn't matter. Depends what school you went to.
I like watching the dimensions fight. I like, because it feels like one of them's like way up on a turret, like up from a turret, shouting down at the other one who's trying to get in. What is the, and then occasionally they flip-flop.
Yeah.
Like one gets in and then gets control of the turret and then the other one's out. And you're like, I just came out to pee. And now this guy's fucking taking over the tower again.
I'm up here, by the way. I can see you making fun of me, mocking. It's pronounced vegan, but I prefer to say vegan because it's like vegan, but you're not sure. Goodbye.
Well, you can get away with any pronunciation. It's like, oh, and that's probably just the way they say it in New Zealand, even though that may not be the case.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, you can get away with. No one's going to correct you.
Yeah,
because you're. If someone's American and they go vegan, you go no, it's vegan. But if you're from another culture and you go, oh, it's vegan, and you're like, oh,
that's how they say it.
That's I prefer that way.
Yeah.
That's nicer than our disgusting tongues.
Yeah.
How many when you start touring are you touring? You said you're touring the States, or you're going to tour?
I'm doing New Zealand and then the UK. And then I'm coming back here in August, so I'll decide what I'm going to do, if I'm going to do it. I mean, doing the States is a huge undertaking, and I'm living here, and it's for me, it's coming back and sort of, getting my teeth into TV and film. That's what I'm in LA for. So
yeah.
To do a massive big live tour, I mean, it would be awesome, But I'd really have to. That would take out a big chunk of my year, and I don't. You know, I've got this new TV show coming out. I just really want to get to the neck. I really like acting. You know, and so I've been doing stand up for so long, and I prefer because I've got two kids and a wife that came with them. it's a good deal. I kind of want to be at home, you know, and looking after my boys. So working on TV allows you to do that. It's more of a normal job. You can go and come back again. Touring's a bitch.
Well, it is. And it's also, it's physically taxing and it's emotionally taxing. Mm-hmm. And then you forget what time zone you're in and you lose touch with people. Mm-hmm. And then you never... I mean, you know, there are guys who can tour like 40 weeks out of the year, and I honestly don't know. I don't know how they do that. I feel like at some point you do have to refill that tank somehow. Mm-hmm. And if you're just out on the road, you're like, I don't even know what town I'm in. I'm in the same hotel that I'm always kind of in, and
you don't do the same show every night. You know, and you know, you can spark it up a bit and have fun, and you know. Jump off the script as much as you like, but at the end of the day, you know, you've still got to hit those punchlines. You've still got to have that ending, and you've still got to come out and meet the crowd. You know, sell your t-shirts, and then go home and then spend, you know, 2 hours calming down.
Yeah,
you know, and kind of have cups of tea and
just staring at the hotel,
sort of jittering, going,
it's probably not a surprise that a lot of but some comics enjoy the drugs
and a lot of the booze,
you know, just to kind of like knock the residue off a little bit.
Yeah, not me though, guys.
No, seriously,
I'm pretty straight.
Not at all.
Yeah.
How much? So with each special that you do every couple of years, do you see? Have you seen like what have you seen as the evolution of your writing and your performance?
That's a good question, and I didn't think there would ever be any evolution, but I realized, of course, there is, and it's come through in the way of stories, the way I tell stories. And it started off, I was doing very random, very surreal things. They were stories, but they were ridiculous, you know, and I was just sort of, you know, believing them, and the people were going, these are funny, but of course, you know, they never happened. He never met a mermaid. but then over time, and I started actually going out there and doing things, and I turned those into stories, and I've done some adventurous stuff just by way of being a comedian, a well-known comic, and getting these opportunities, like, you know, going to Africa and searching for mountain gorillas, climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. Going to Loch Ness various times.
These are things you've done?
These are things I've really done.
You climbed Kilimanjaro?
Yeah.
How did...
Well, last year.
Jesus. Did that take months of preparation? Or
No.
You just go up it?
No. I spent the whole time in that other dimension. So he he was fantastic. He didn't need any training whatsoever. I did a lot of running, a lot of sort of some altitude work. But really, for me, it was... In my head, it was just walking upwards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can do that. So I didn't even think really about how much the altitude was gonna affect me. And unfortunately, when I got there, I also had the flu. I had a sore throat. And I was already committed to do this. And the higher I got up, the worse it was. And I only just made it, to be honest. I mean, they were nearly going to take me down. I say they, you know, the mountain gods.
Go down, my son.
No, I've come all this way. It's for world vision.
All right. Well, I can get up there.
So I struggled. That was the hardest thing I've ever done, was climbing that mountain.
I would imagine so. Yeah, I would imagine so. Did you have, when you finally got to the, can you get to the tippy top, or is it just like a near the top?
There's a top. It's sort of a crater at the top. So I got to the summit. And then when you get to the top, there's also, you can go round this crater, and there's a little higher bit, which you can go an extra hour, and you can go and you can say you've been to the even higher bit, which I didn't do, because when I got to the top, I was just an emotional wreck, and I was crying, and then the guides, they said, look, you got to get this guy down. He's no good. So I went down, and so I ran down.
In about 20 minutes.
And I was down in 20 minutes, and you could hear me running down going, woohoo! See you later, suckers! Mountains of bullshit!
What is it?
How long does it take to get up?
6 days.
Jesus!
Yeah. And so we camped along the way. We took the slow route so that we could acclimatize. And then... or acclimatize. How do you say it?
Acclimatize.
Yeah. And then... And then the last stint was 6 hours, and we left at midnight for the last 6 hour bit, which was straight up walking up scree, which is just like stones, like, you know, gravel, in zigzag fashion. Left at midnight so that we got to the top for sunrise.
Oh my God.
And it was amazing. So we got to the top, and then you could just see a full 360 of Africa as the sun was coming up, and you're just thinking, wow, okay, this is worth it. This is the earth, guys. This is where it all began. You know, you're in Africa for a start. And you just feel it's such an amazing place. It's nothing else feels like when you're in Africa. The smells and the sights. It's kind of like you feel like where everything began. And then you are at the top of this mountain, looking down. And of course, I couldn't see very well because my eyes were so blurry with all the tears. So I felt like I was underwater. But I sort of blinked it away and had a quick look, but really had to go back down pretty quickly because, I was struggling. I was walking so slow on that 6 hour walk that I felt like I was an old man in a rest home in the middle of the night trying to get down the corridor to the bathroom, you know, with a walker. And because I was literally walking this kind of pace. And once again, not very good on the audio systems here, but if you could imagine a very slow man walking.
He's hunched over and then slowly he's holding he's doing a spacework of a walker.
And then I had three sets of gloves on, so cold and still really cold. I had three sets of gloves on, one hand in a pocket so that they would get that extra warmth, the other hand with the stick. We had a stick, you know, and then do swapsies. So when that one got too cold, I'd, right, you're swapping over, and I'd grab it to the other one, and then this one would be sort of warm because it was in the pocket, and then I'd put that hand in the pocket, and that was my technique, and then I'd walk again at this kind of pace, very, very slowly, and you know, I was the last of my group because of my breathing was not good. I was struggling because of this chest infection I had. And then when I got down the bottom, I saw a sign that said, if you've got a sore throat, don't go any higher than 3,000 meters.
Fuck you, sign.
Yeah.
I'll show you. I'll tell you what I'm going to do out of respect. I'm going to turn this heater off because I feel very... What is it, like 68 in here? I mean, how does a person even exist? I mean, I feel like that's such a... It's just one of those experiences that you could never even relay with words. You would just someone would just have to experience that thing. But then how do you know when you've experienced it enough? Like, you get up there and go, how much am I supposed to shove this into my senses to make it a thing? I went all this way. Is this it? I mean, did it teach you anything about goal acquisition? And, you know, like, it's more the journey, or is it really about the goal and the summit? Or
I learned that it really is about the journey and certainly not the goal. And I think, you know, it's the chase, you know, and I think that is the answer to life is chasing and experiencing the chase. And we often forget that because we're so busy chasing, we're trying to find that goal. But of course, once you've got the goal, that's the end. You never want to get to the end. And if you do want to get to the end, if you do get to the end, which of course we all do in life eventually, folks.
Oh, what? God damn, spoiler.
You can try and extend it as much as you can, but you've really got to enjoy the journey. And I mean, I really enjoyed the journey down, but for me, it was the memories of the awful journey up that will stick with me forever. And so memory is the most amazing thing. If I was to lose that memory, it's, you know, it was like I would never have done it. So, but that's obvious.
Would you have, were you depressed at all afterwards? Like, oh, it's over now. Like, or was it just, appreciation and I can't wait to get back to medicine.
Yeah,
and...
really happy. Really, really, really stoked, as we say.
How long does it take to get back down?
2 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
6 days up, 2 days down. Did you have to go to the hospital afterwards, or did they just give you some antibiotics and you were okay?
I was on stuff the whole time and I was okay. Yeah, I got better.
It almost seems like now that I'm getting some context, this, you know, this character, this sort of stage character of like, oh, I'm the adventurer,
mm-hmm.
like that, actually putting real adventures. Does that character drive you to seek out that kind of stuff so that you? Because it gives that stuff more weight, knowing that shit's actually real.
Yeah.
But then you're adding flair on top of it, makes it really interesting.
I think so. I think that's you've hit the nail on the head there. You have to do stuff to, you know, even to mock experience that you've done it, because otherwise there's no reality in it. And I think, you know, the strongest comedy has a very strong sense of reality in it. And that's why mockumentaries work so well. And because, you know, if you believe something, even when we look back at the Concords, the scenes that we were doing in there, which a lot were improvised, but even the ones that weren't, we acted them in a way that is just seemed real. We weren't being silly. And yet the subject matter or the dialogue was ridiculous. But you for some reason you believed that these guys were, you know, having a band meeting inside this guy's office where clearly he should be doing other things.
Did Murray really believe all the things that he said, or was he sugarcoat everything, or did he really believe all that?
All the things he believes it all. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, he spent time in the New Zealand Army. You know, he was lucky enough. He was separated from his wife Shelley, and he had, you know, he had sadness there. He always wanted to be cool, and he's attached himself to these cool looking idiots because they had guitars and great, you know, great haircuts, and so therefore that was his. He was then cool, and drinking a beer was cool, you know. And so I think, yeah, I get envious about how simple his mind is, because he found a lot of happiness through those guys. I think
that's what's so great is that it, with a character like that, it seems like if you can start from a real place, this guy wants a real thing. He wants to be cool. He mm-hmm. wants to be near it, or he wants to be part of it. Then I feel like it's sort of like a paddleball game where that tethers you to then be able to go as ridiculous as you want, because ultimately the things that he wants are real.
Yeah.
So no matter how he goes about trying to get those things or the things that he says, you know that it all is grounded in that kind of basic need.
Yeah. And I think the funny thing is that he could have all that without having to do any of that, you know, but he puts so much emphasis on what needs to be done, you know, in terms of the roll call and then the agenda and, you know, and charts and things like that.
Yeah.
And really, you could just throw all that away and just be yourself.
Well, that's the thing. There is an interesting lesson in there between doing and being, is that, and I think it also ties back to comedy in the sense that I think when most people, or at least when I started out, but I feel like most people, you think of comedy as this thing that you have to do. It's this thing that you have to engineer. And then I think the more you do it, you're like, oh, no, you just sort of be. You just be yourself.
Yes.
You can be funny without trying to do funny, per se.
Yeah, and I think that comes with experience. And when we first start doing comedy, live comedy in front of people, we do what we think they're going to laugh at. And we're not being ourselves. We're sort of, you know, telling stories or making up things, telling jokes that we hope people will like. And over time, you know, when people keep telling you, hey, you're onto it, you're doing well, you know, people are loving it. Oh, I'll keep going. Yeah, keep going, man, keep going. What? I don't know what to say next. Well, go and do something, experience something.
Get out there, you're on the lights.
Yeah. Okay, hi, everyone. Yay.
Boom.
Get off. Come on, I thought I had it. You need to, you got to be true to yourself. And it's funny because that takes time. And when I first began, you know, that... I don't know who that was. It certainly wasn't me from another dimension. It was me desperately, you know, trying to make people laugh, I guess. And when I first started doing comedy, I had this thing where I didn't want them to stop laughing. So I would just, you know, constantly be on. And if there was some lulls or anything, I'd be, oh, I've lost them.
No, no, no.
Hey, they're not laughing.
laughing. Quick, oh, get me off now.
And that's Rhys Darby, folks. 1 minute 30 there.
Hello, everyone. I'll just wrap it up with this.
Well, he got consistent laughs there at 1 minute 30. Looks like there was going to be a hesitation. He's gone. And so we're moving on to the next guy.
I'm going to double down tonight. I'm going to do a tight three. I'm going to do a tight. Light me at two. I'll wrap it up in a tight three.
Trust me, after 2 minutes, I do get boring. But then, as the years progressed, I realized, hey, look, they're quite happy just sitting there, listening to you. Just calm down. And then you've got to have things to say. And so then was finding those things to say. So then doing things and living my life. And then, when odd things happened, remembering it, writing it down. Every comic has a notebook, and exchanges between people, something, anything that makes you laugh goes in the notebook, and then it finds its way onto stage. It might not be that week or that year even, but, we go through our notebooks years down the track, and this new show I've just written has a story in it that has been in my notebook for probably 10 years, and only now is the right time to bring it out, because I'm trying to find an ending to it, or trying to find bits in it that are going to, work. And I've attempted it a few times, and it just hasn't been right, but now's the time.
Well, sifting through old notebooks, sometimes your brain doesn't have the tool set.
Yeah.
Like, you have an idea, but you're like, I don't know what to... So I found an old notebook from 1996. And of course, now I think, oh, I've been doing comedy for all these years, and I'm so much more evolved than I was back then. And fucking, I flipped open the page, and the first thing I saw was a goddamn Doctor Who joke from like 1996.
Yeah.
And it just like, oh, and part of me was sad. I'm like, I haven't really grown. I mean, I know I've grown as a performer. But then I was also like, oh, okay, you know what? I'm still kind of the same guy. Like, I see nuggets of things that now I'm more equipped to express than I was back then.
Yeah, I think, and that's a good rule. Just, if there's comics out there, keep your notebooks, and don't get discouraged if a lot of that stuff in there isn't going to work. You know it's not going to work, but there's something there. There's a seed.
Yeah.
And over time, that plant will grow.
With the rain and fertilizer of experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Jim Jefferies was here last night. And he was saying that you did... did you do one or two, a couple episodes
I
of Legit?
I did two, yeah.
Yeah. And he said it was a blast.
It's a great show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome. I sort of played... let's wait and see what I play. But it's kind of... you won't be surprised. It's me, but in the other dimension.
Well, I would imagine probably on, if a comic is running a show, but when you work on other things, are you good at sticking to what's written, or do you say like, well, can I just take a pass at this myself?
Oh, totally. It's got to the point now where it's kind of expected. So I would do what's written, and then, you always do three or four takes on things, and I say, hey, I've got this idea, can I do this? And they say yes, and then we'll do it, and then after that, do you want to do any more? Yeah, I've actually got quite a few other options here. Oh god, all right, well, we've got a couple of minutes, I suppose. And so so I've been lucky to particularly on Legit, I had lots of ideas when I was standing at the door, and when the door opened, and they just let me go, and it was a lot of fun. So hopefully, and then they can pick and choose. But I'll always, with respect, do the proper gear.
Yeah. Do you see that the character evolve, like changing at any point? You're like, maybe he's going to go darker. Maybe I'm going to abandon that and just do a whole different guy, or maybe I'm going to different layers. Or
no, I definitely keep it within the realm of what's written and what's expected of me. And don't often go dark.
Yeah,
it's kind of not within me unless the character is dark. And when I think one day when I really do go dark, it's gonna be very, very scary.
So was Short Poppies a show that what happened before and then you brought it to Netflix, or did you do it specifically for Netflix?
No, yeah, I made it in New Zealand last year, and We own it, my wife and I. And,
nice.
And yeah, so we thought, and it's for New Zealand television, but because we own it, I wanted the whole world to see it. So we brought it back here and I said, hey, Netflix, check this out. And they went, oh, yeah, not bad, not bad. and they really wanted to put on straight away. And I said, oh, can you please wait? Because New Zealand kind of want to see it first. And I know, you know, what, back at the village, they'll be like, hey, why you put that out there? We haven't even seen it first, Reese. That's my mother.
You can see it now on Netflix. No, yeah, it doesn't count.
No, because they don't get Netflix.
Oh, they don't?
Yeah.
There's no New Zealand Netflix?
No. Nor does Australia.
Son of a shit.
Yeah. So that there was the problem, and so we've sort of waited. And Netflix said, "Oh, we'll wait a bit then," you know, and which was great because then I got to do more publicity for it and stuff, and then New Zealand, who have television, New Zealand, who are going to put it on air, later this year, also have a on demand function with the smart TVs and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they turned around and said, "Look, hey, Reese, we'll just chuck it on our on demand so that the people here can watch it," which they've done. So I'm glad it's that New Zealand have done that, and so it's really pretty much dropped at the same time all over the world.
So what's the pitch of the show ultimately?
What is it? Okay, it's a mockumentary series. It's really about a reporter who is sent into the heart of New Zealand to find the ordinary folk and to spend a day in the life with seven different people and find out, you know, what makes them tick. So the title Short Poppies comes from the term Tall Poppy Syndrome, which is a syndrome we don't really have in America. But in other parts of the world, particularly back home, it's a thing where if you stick your neck out, you know, someone's going to cut it off.
Oh, right, yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. So over here, of course, you know, if you stick your neck out, you know, people will go, wow, awesome, you're sticking your neck out.
Great neck.
Yeah, great neck, man. And then they'll come behind you and lift you up so you're even higher. And then, you know, and then if you topple, then it's your own fault.
Of course.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah, oh, well, bad luck, man. Try again next year. And you can. And you can try again the next week. You know, you can redeem yourself here, which is great. But in our other countries, I guess, Australia, even in the UK as well, is a little bit of, oh, who does he think he is? You know, calm down, mate. And particularly in New Zealand, a very small village, rural situation, I like it to think of it as this guy thinks he's going to be an All Black, which was our rugby team, and you're not good enough. You know, you'll never get to wear the black jersey, but you can be good enough, and you've got to prove yourself. And it's just as that feeling of, look, settle down, because it's that laid back thing of New Zealand as well. Don't get too excited. Don't jump up and down. It's just all keep cool. All right, you've got to finish milking the cows anyway. So don't, you know.
I don't know what you're so excited about.
Yeah, what are you so excited? Television and films for us to watch, not to be in.
You don't.
You know. You don't be in it.
It's for other people.
It's why we watch them there from overseas. And you know, and of course I went overseas and started being in these things. I got back and they went, oh, here he is. So you're in those things, are you? Well, we're not impressed.
Yeah.
You know.
That's really interesting to think about, you know, when you have a tighter-knit community that everyone's aware of each other, and then someone tries to get more attention. It's like, well, why do you need any more than any one of us? But in a culture like, you know, America or Los Angeles, where there are so many people, you kind of have to do that.
Yeah, otherwise
you just get absorbed and disappear. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms of, you know, like why a small community might be like, well, what else do you need? You're getting, we all know who you are. We all give you attention.
And that's not to say that, you know, most people were really happy and excited about, you know, the success we had with the Concords and everything. But, you know, it's just, for me, it was a fun name. And also the idea is that I would play, the ironic thing is that I would play all of those characters. So therefore showing off seven times again and wearing...
Oh, Reese, what have you done?
But can't you see the... No, we can't. You just, you know...
Seven, really?
Seven different people? What, you know, why? Can't you just be yourself? Oh, I don't even know who that is anymore. What are you talking up? Get back inside.
I mean, even Neil Finn only had Split Ends, Crowded House, and the Finn Brothers in a solo career. That's four.
Yeah, yeah.
You had to do seven things.
Mm. Well, we're not watching it.
Yeah. But I wanted to make sure you got to see it first.
And the other thing about the show is that, so it's a series of long-form interviews. So this reporter, David Ferrier, he's a friend of mine, he's a real reporter, and he goes out into the field and he meets, you know, the small New Zealand budget, he only goes to one small town. So the people that he finds are all just living in that same town. So they, the characters keep coming back into the background and sort of they end up sort of intertwining a bit. And it gave great scope for me to improvise because of the interview situation. So we actually see David on screen. He asks his questions about, so what's happening here? What, how does your day start? And this kind of thing. And then I'll be the character and then I'll be able to just completely go off script. So it was one of the fun things I love doing. So I thought, well, if I'm going to create my own show, that has to be what happens. And I had to get a guy that was going to go opposite me that wasn't going to just crack up the whole time.
Sure.
And he's, because he's a friend of mine, he's almost bored with me. So he keeps a straight face and, you know, it's kind of, it's fun.
So did you pitch that to New Zealand Television or did you fund it yourself and then give it to them?
Yeah, no, we pitched it to New Zealand Television and the
it's
New
amazing
Zealand.
You got to own it.
Yeah. The New Zealand funding body, New Zealand On Air, gave us money to make it, and then, you know, but it's ours, and so therefore, the intention always was for the rest of the world to see it. So we spent a lot of money on making it good enough, technically, visually, that we could then throw it out there, and people would go, oh yeah, this is very modern, very very good looking. You know, it's not in black and white or anything. Is it just a full color scenario here?
So in effect, is
cameras and everything,
lights, you have electricity.
Yeah.
So in effect, it is sort of a commercial for New Zealand production.
It is, and as much as it is about the New Zealand way of life and about our people and how uniquely funny they are, even though I'm playing all of them.
Yeah.
I think what we were surprised with the Concords when we made that the world really took to it. We thought it was so novelty, so niche that, you know, over here people are like, oh, it's weird. I don't even really get what's going on with those guys, you know. And why is he managing them? And what? I can't even understand their accents. And we did have the odd email coming through saying, New Zealand, what is that? Is that a made-up place?
Yeah. You know, like... Jesus Christ.
That was from some Americans that thought... We got asked, what drama school did you guys go to? I mean, great, this fantasy idea of a place called New Zealand.
Is that an acting school?
Yeah,
what is that?
Yeah, yeah. So once we realized that there was an interest in the uniqueness of our sort of... laconic, you know, dry and absurd humour. Then I thought, well, let's take an extra step and set the next one actually back in New Zealand, so people can then really see where we came from.
Yeah,
and see a lot more, not only just characters, but more interaction between myself and all the other actors. So there's quite a few actors in this, and they're comedian actors, and they're all Kiwis. And there's a few big names, Sam Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, yeah,
yeah,
of course.
So about him. And Stephen Merchant and Carl Urban.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and you'll be surprised with him when you see what he did.
Carl Urban is fucking great. And I know that he, and the interesting thing is he's been in a ton of huge movies, but I don't know if you said to the average American, like, Carl Urban, I think they'd be like, what? Oh, the guy who was in this.
Yeah, you've always got to say
that
the guy.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe... Star Trek kind of blew him up a little bit more, but he's really a phenomenal actor.
Yeah, he's awesome. And then, of course, when he does Dredd, he never takes the mask off.
He never takes the mask off, yeah.
But that's great for him because I think he's... I don't know whether he's designed that way so that he can still just get around and not have anyone poking him for photos, but I think short poppies will change that.
You're going to change that for Carl. You're going to be the thing that tips.
Yeah.
Is the idea that... Because I assume that Lord of the Rings has essentially...
flip-flopped the tourism industry in New Zealand. I'm sure a lot of people went to New Zealand before, but now it's like, let's go see the Shire.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing, or is that sort of like, are the Kiwis kind of like, yeah, we get it. We know that it's here.
Get out. Thank you. Get out.
You've seen it.
Leave those keys here. They're not yours.
Yeah, that's how we feel.
You're dropping some litter. Thank you. We have trash cans. We call them rubbish bins.
Wait, I love this character all of a sudden. Just a series of shorts of the head of the tourism board. Just like watch it. You never see what he's looking at, but he's just calling out all these different tourists. Of like, please don't.
On the monitors. Yeah, and he's got a little microphone.
I can see you, camera 5 on the beach. Thank you. We wear trunks here.
Yes, you can kick over the homes in the Shire. Yeah, yeah. They're very small.
Whose is that ball? Is that one of ours? Give it back to Brian, please. I can't understand what he's talking about. He's...
That just I think you could do an entire just like 11-minute series of short or 5 or 2 11-minute series of shorts of just that guy.
Yeah.
Just as a matter of
New Zealand from his from his office with the cameras.
As a matter of fact, I would think that the New Zealand Tourism Board would probably, that totally feels like a character that you could see in commercials, like, hey, yeah, you know, sort of this, you respect the land, but the guy who's just a little into...
Welcome to New Zealand, you know, do whatever you like, and then it cuts to him.
Okay, that's not a man-made track. That's for the sheep. Oh, God. Come back. Oh, yes, I'm here in the bush. Look at the camera. Here, I can see you. Put your top back on, for heaven's sake.
All right. Okay, now put it back on.
Now put it. There we go.
3, 2. Okay, now. That would be amazing. All right, listen, if you want to shoot that, we'll shoot that for you.
Man.
And I'm thrilled that you're on At Midnight tonight.
Oh, I can't wait.
I mean, you're welcome to come on whenever you want. Because my favorite thing about the show is just watching how everyone attacks everything and how they interact with one another. And you have such a, your voice on the show is so different than anyone else's that it's really it adds a really fun element to the show.
Yeah, cool. I can't wait. And the people we're on with tonight, I'm fans of, so I look forward to it.
Yeah, you're on with Amber Tamblyn and Kurt Brown. Is Kurt Brown Oler?
Yeah,
Kurt Brown Oler too. Yeah, it'll be a good panel. So Short Poppies is on Netflix now.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, it depends when this goes out.
When is it going up, Katie? The 25th.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's out tomorrow, so it's out now.
Is this going up tomorrow, Katie, or like in a couple of weeks? It's going up in a couple of weeks. Okay, so it's definitely out.
Yeah, it's definitely out.
But this has been a really, really wonderful chat, and I'm so glad. I ran into you in an airport like the day after you did At Midnight, and I felt I was in kind of a haze because I was like, oh, I'm tired and I got to travel. And I didn't know what to say, and I felt dumb because I'm like, oh, hey, Reese, how's it going? And you never think beyond the, hey, how's it going?
Now,
what are we going to talk about? So I felt like I sort of dropped the ball. Where I was like, hey, I got nothing now.
Nice shoes. Yes, thank you.
Those, did you get those on the internet?
No, they're fully purchased. You want to see the receipts?
I would.
I've got to catch a plane, mate.
So is it Reese Darby on Twitter?
At Reese Darby.
Reese Darby, at Reese Darby on Twitter.
In the middle there, someone took my name.
Who takes your name?
I don't know.
There's no other Reese Darbys in the world.
Ridiculous. Yeah.
Twitter should be able to get that back for you.
But yeah, I don't want to start again. I've got over 140 followers. I'm not starting again.
All right, here we go. One.
Yeah, start again.
Two.
First tweet back. Oh, nice day.
That character is the guy that could just go out to Hollywood and Highland and just try to recruit Twitter followers.
Yeah.
Would you like to sign up now?
Yeah. Sign up here. There we go. And that's the Twitter feed. You'll have to follow me on that. And I'm doing one at 2:00. I'm just going to see what's going to happen around that time. Heading into a shop shortly. So hopefully there'll be some sort of interaction there. All right, thanks a lot. I need that pen back. Hey! Damn it. Well, that's it for today. One follower.
That's that guy from New Zealand who comes to America to try to...
It wasn't.
he's come
he's
over.
He's trying to conquer America. Yeah. I see you. You have no jersey. You have no authority here, but he's still. Yeah. Well, it's good to see you, man. I'll see you in just a couple hours for at midnight.
Cool, man.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. You should tell people to enjoy their burrito. You have a better voice than I do.
Enjoy your burritos.
See?
It's always slightly elevated and yelling.
I think. Yeah. Everything's always
Enjoy your burritos?
I don't...
Is it?
Maybe.
Okay, up to you. Let's Google burritos.
Perfect.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.